Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, and Dale Isla Riggs of the Berry Patch. If you have a question about something going on in your garden or something you'd like to go on in your garden, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Email if you want. voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number, 800-348-2551. Always a popular show. My advice is for you to call early if you're going to call at all. Fred, Dale Isla, and Greg coming up on The Gardening Show right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Gardening Today. We welcome back Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York, and Dale Isla Riggs, owner and operator of the Berry Patch, a first-generation diversified firm in Stephen Farm, not firm. It's not a Wall Street firm. It's a farm in Steventown, New York. Should be able to read the scripts that I write. We welcome your gardening calls at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again is 800-348-2551. Dale Isla Riggs, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here. It's a glorious time of year.
It really is. And based on what you have brought, I agree with your assessment of the thing. Hey, Fred Breglia, welcome back. How are things over at the Landis?
They're growing, and we're doing good. And thanks for having us back here.
And you brought stuff, too. And we'll get into all that in a minute. First, a mea culpa. I had Greg Ward down as being here today, and you both knew that he wasn't coming. I'm supposed to produce the show, and I know he sent an email because you got it as well.
Yeah, he had sent it a while ago, though, so it depends on, you know, how far back you look. It was a while ago when he said he wasn't coming.
All right, so just to check off the boxes, one, I can't read. Two, I cannot produce a program. But thank God you brought all this wonderful produce, both of you.
You're welcome.
And
'tis the season.
Dale Isla, tell us first, before we get to your science exhibit, which I want to talk about at length, just tell us some of the stuff you brought.
Yeah, so I brought a variety of tomatoes. It's the tomato time of year. It's been the tomato time of year for about the last month and a half. I think some people start to get a little tired of tomatoes at this time of year. But it's the last few weeks where they're really going to have great flavor. When we start getting cooler nights, the flavor is not nearly as good. So I brought in 6 varieties of heirlooms and 2 varieties of standard red types that we can try, one of the heirloom types, is my own personal variety that I identified quite a few years ago now, that I've been saving seed and trying to refine it and getting to the point where I might approach a seed company about it.
Ooh, now when you say refine it, what do you mean?
So when you first get a mutation, basically, and you're saving seed from it, you'll get a wide variety of shapes, sizes, colors, etc. And so my variety is, in general, kind of gold to olive green. But over time, I've been finding some that are more of a persimmony type color, a little golder, and also have smaller blossom end scars. So that's what I've been trying to refine the variety down to, is to get rid of more of the olive green part of it and get it a little more of that gold orange. And a lot of them have really big blossom end scars, and that doesn't tend to be real acceptable in the commercial trade. So I've been trying to choose fruit that have very small blossom end scars, just a little tiny spot on the bottom of the fruit where the blossom had been.
And you're feeling like you're getting there?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't wait to try it. I don't know if I've ever tried an heirloom tomato, except that, Fred, are some of those that you so nicely, you brought a bag a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, a few of those varieties were.
A
few of them were from an organic seed source, not necessarily heirloom, but they were organically grown, and then the seeds were then collected that way. So they're a combination of the two. The potatoes are also heirloom.
Oh, and they're so great. Yeah. And by the way, I mentioned your name Friday during the Food Friday program because it was about baking with vegetables.
Oh, great.
And my wife made, using your tomatoes, this incredible tomato cheese pie.
It looked amazing.
The tomatoes really were a rockin' hit. So it's great. A great time of year, and everything looks fabulous. We got a few emails here, and then we'll hit the phones. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in, and we will get to the phone shortly. This email came in at 10 o'clock this morning from Joseph at Mona in Bern, New York. With the recent drought, we thought we had lost a number of our Dawn redwoods when they lost their needles. But with the recent rains, some of them are beginning to come back and are leafing out again. Question: will this re-leafing impact how the trees behave in the spring? And that's from Joseph and Mona in Bern, New York.
Yeah, so, you know, it shouldn't really affect too much. A lot of leaves have been shed earlier this year because of drought. And basically the trees, it's happening at the end of summer. So when you have leaves that fall off trees or plants at the end of summer, it's mimicking kind of the same time span that they would kind of fall off, only a little bit prematurely. And that's just because it's getting dry and they want to store energy for next season. And they say, you know, we just don't have adequate moisture. And they literally start to call off leaves. And not only will they, you know, throw leaves off, they'll also reduce a lot of fruit. Like, we had an apple tree at our yard that probably we lost probably 2/3 of the apples due to drought. And and now we still have a lot of apples on that tree, but 2/3 gone. And that was all because just there wasn't enough, you know, partially it's too much fruit for the tree to support, but certainly not enough water. And next year those Dawn redwoods should pop back and look good.
Okay. This email from Ernie in Scotia. I planted a tree with my brother in Colony last fall. It was a clearance autumn blaze maple about 7 or 8 feet tall. I believe we did all the correct things, but it did not come back in the spring, except the very bottom. There are small branches coming out of the tree and ground, making a small bush shape. I included a picture if this is helpful. Sadly, I don't believe it's going to be helpful, as the printer, well, I don't even know, you can take a look at it. I don't even know what side is up there. When should we thin this out and cut the dead trunk is the question. What other steps should be done for the upcoming years with the eventual goal of a single trunk maple?
Yeah, so well, they're certainly along. They're thinking correctly in everything that they said there. So basically the tree, they got it a clearance. It may have had some stress. It may have had some issues. Most likely died, at least partially died because of winter injury. Just probably didn't go through the winter really good and didn't have enough energy to come out. And then part of the tree sounds like it's alive, so they are going to need to retrain a single trunk tree from a bunch or cluster of branches. And, you know, really what you're going to want to let that plant, you could wait till it was dormant and you could prune a few branches off, but because they're bleeder species, maples, birches, things that are bleeders, we tend to wait till the summertime to prune. So I would let the plant just leave everything alone, let it go to sleep, dormancy in the winter, protect the trunk this year that's remaining from any type of animals that, like voles that could girdle it.
Yeah.
And then let it all flush out in the springtime. And then I would say after the spring flush, you're looking at mid-June,
okay,
I would selectively start to train a single leader out of that.
All right.
And then I would head back or reduce, doesn't mean remove all the branches, but reduce the branches that you don't want. And by sort of cutting the tips of those branches that you don't want, and ultimately may even remove, you're able to retain the foliage and therefore provide more photosynthesis, more food-making mechanisms to that plant. It'll get bigger faster. So you're just going to leave the one stem that you don't want, that you do want to retain, leave that one unpruned. And trees and plants, like humans, grow through hormonal flows. And when you sort of head back the side branches, you're telling the hormonal flow to go to the top, and it'll produce a really large branch that'll turn into the new leader. And then you're going to suppress lateral branches. And over a course of a couple of years, you should be able to retrain that tree into a really nice specimen. I would recommend you go to treesaregood.org. It's a website put out by the International Society of Arboriculture. It's free, and it's a resource for everyone. And you could print it off, or you could just look at it on your computer or phone. And it'll give you really good examples of pruning cuts and how to make proper pruning cuts, because you can make wrong cuts, you can make right cuts, and, you know, making a difference will make a big difference in the health of the plant. So treesaregood.org. Gotcha. For more info on that.
All right. Fred Bregley is here from Landis Arboretum, and Dale Isla Riggs from The Berry Patch, a farm, a diversified farm and not a firm, in Steventown, New York. And before we take our break and then hit the phones at 800-348-2551, Dale Isla, you brought in this jar with some very odd specimens. And this goes back to last program, correct?
Either last program or maybe two programs ago, where a person called in asking about how to control tomato hornworm in their tomatoes.
Right.
And during that program, I talked about if you see any hornworms with little white cocoons coming out of them, those are really good to keep because that is a parasitic wasp that has parasitized the tomato hornworm. And that's what I brought in today.
That is so cool.
It is cool. And this hornworm's about 2 inches long at this point, and it's got, probably 30 to 50 cocoons sticking out of it. I actually have a couple others in this jar, one of which got attacked by the parasite earlier, so you can see the end result.
Yeah.
And there is the
That's one dead
50,
worm there.
Yeah.
30 to 50 cocoons, and it's a black kind of icky mess at this point. And I've got one other that I had saved from a week ago that one got a little moldy. But most of these have actually hatched out already because if you look closely, not this green one that I have right here, because this worm's still a little bit alive.
Ah, splendid.
Yeah. But the other ones, you can actually see a little tiny hole cut at the very top of the cocoon. And that's what the adult wasp emerged out of to go do this process.
Okay,
again.
There's no wasps in there, right? Because Studio A is very small and there's really no escape once they start flying around.
That's they're not hatching out now and they're okay. Little tiny.
So we'll
things.
Be okay.
They will not go after a human. They only like hornworms.
All right, let's take a break here now. I feel much better. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's The Gardening Show. Fred Breglia and Dale Isla Riggs will answer your questions coming up. You see, Fred, when you make my mother's special sandwich, it is bacon on toast, peanut butter on the bacon, slice of tomato, and we have some beautiful tomatoes here, mayo on the top piece of bread. That's it. That's all there is to it. There's no lettuce. Make sure you don't put lettuce
on. So that'll throw it off. All right. Good to know.
It sounds like it would be horrible, but it's really wonderful.
Well, you know, I've never had anything with bacon that I can say is bad, so...
I got a couple pounds the other day, which, by the way, I had to take a second mortgage out to do now, but we're going to do that.
They do chocolate bacon. Ever had chocolate bacon?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've never eaten it, but it I'm sure it's on my list.
My brother and I used to do peanut butter chocolate bacon.
There you go.
And it was, you know, not good for you, obviously, but...
But delicious.
Super delicious. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Before I do that, the heirloom tomato, Dale Isla, that you came up with or you have been improving... It's spectacular. I love
Great.
The taste. It's got a meaty taste to it. It almost has a sweetness to it.
Yep, not a lot of acid either.
Not a lot of acid. Yep. Nice and lots of meat in the tomato.
Yep. Love it.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, and we'll sample some more coming up here, but let's go to Anita in Clinton. Anita, you're on.
Hi, this is for Fred. I was out walking in the deciduous forest and saw... The strangest thing, identified it as beach blight aphids, and it was covering two branches of this small sapling. So I wondered, is it going to spread to the rest of the forest and how to get rid of it?
Yeah, so, the beech bark disease is what I'm assuming you're talking about, and you know, in terms of spreading. But, you know, it's really here. There's no good way to get rid of it. Some trees have higher levels of resistance, it seems like. But, you know, generally speaking, that beech bark disease is a real problem, and it has been for a really long time. The majority of large beech trees that you would associate with sort of the climax ecosystem where you would find them is usually devoid of that species in any kind of large capacity. So you'll see large sugar maples, you'll see large hemlocks, you'll see some really big yellow birch, the classic climax forest of the Northeast, and then you'll often see a lot of deteriorated old beeches and a bunch of young beeches, but rarely Rare to see an intact ecosystem where you see those large beech trees, American beech trees anymore. The European beech, seems to be a lot more resistant and doesn't really get the beech bark disease as much. But there's also a beech bark a beech leaf disease that's also threatening a lot of our beaches now, too. So, unfortunately, beaches are not doing so well. I wish I had better news.
Well, this was aphids. It was a long mass of white, soft, little tiny things that were waving in the breeze.
Okay, if they were woolly aphid, then they're just probably secondary and not going to create a huge problem. And you're talking about fluffy white kind of cotton, and that they just go on a lot of plants. They're sort of a nuisance, but not part of the big problem, which is plaguing our forest, which is especially with beaches, bark disease and now beech leaf disease. But the woolly aphids are not really a big problem. If that's what it was, I didn't see the insect.
Okay, thanks.
If you have any photos and you'd like to pass them along, I could ID that insect correctly for you. You could email it to fred@landisarboretum.org.
Okay.
If you took some photos, I'd like to see it so I could ID the pest correctly.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Vox Pop Gardening Show. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Fred Breglia from the Landis Arboretum is here. Dalila Riggs from the Berry Patch. While Fred was giving that answer, Dalila, I had a bite of one of these tomatoes, and there's no name on it.
Black Crim.
Black Crim. They're very interesting now. Is that an heirloom tomato as well?
That is also an heirloom, originally from Russia. And it's a pretty easy one to find in the seed catalogs. So very, very flavorful.
It is. And again, a lot of nice mass to it. Tastes very tasty. It's very good. Fred, did you try that one?
I did not try that one yet, but I'm going to have to.
And then I'll go to the phones at Mary in Albany. Mary, you're on.
Yes. I bought a dwarf Alberta spruce tree in a 10-gallon container. I'd say it's about 2.5 feet tall. And I live in an apartment, and I have a very sunny balcony, and it was out there all summer. And just recently, I transferred it from a 10-gallon container to a large pot. I would say it's probably a 20-gallon container. My question is, first, is it being cruel to make this tree live in a container? And secondly, what precautions should I take? The balcony's going to be sunny all winter, but it's going to get very cold. Should I take the tree in, or should I do something to it outdoors to let it stay outdoors? I really don't know what to do unless I have to just give it to somebody to put in the ground on their property. But this is an apartment balcony where it's living.
Yeah, so ultimately you are going to want to – the plant would have to go through the cold cycle, and it has to have its roots in the ground in order to insulate them from the freeze. So if you left it on the balcony, the plant would go through the cold cycle, but the roots would be – they would get too cold for that plant to survive. So you would have to, if you wanted to keep it, you could, if you don't have room to plant it, which would be ideal, if you wanted to keep it as a containerized patio plant, you could plant it container and all in your yard. So you dig the hole to the depth of the container and you drop it in the hole, container and all, and then and it'll stay the winter there. And you could actually put a little mulch over the top of the container and water it in well before winter. And then in the spring, you would be able to pop that container back out of the ground, and you would be able to repeat that process that you just did again, keeping it on your patio. Ultimately, the plant will grow slow, and ultimately the roots would end up probably starting to get really crowded in that container. So then you would, if you wanted to continue this cycle, you would probably ultimately start to create maybe a large bonsai in a way. You would start to have to prune roots in order to keep the tree at probably a size that's manageable. But you could certainly do it that way. But if you are going to winter it over, then the easiest way for that would be to plant it container or all. Don't even take it out, right in a hole in your yard, and mulch it in and water it in, and it'll work. I hold over a lot of plants that we grow at Landis Arboretum that we don't sell at the sales, and we have them for the rest of the year. We basically are going to, if we don't sell them, we're going to plant them container and all in a holding yard. And then in the spring, we pop those containers out and then we put them back out for sale or we plant them. But generally, that's how we hold
now,
over our old winter. Go ahead.
Would it be harmful to bring it in for the winter in a sunny window?
It wouldn't survive if you didn't go through the cold period. You'd end up losing that plant ultimately, long term.
Okay.
Yeah.
What if I just brought it in on freezing cold nights? Would that help?
You know, I don't think you want the plant to kind of go to sleep, and I think that the winter temperatures above ground would get too cold for the root system.
So,
you know, generally, if you left all these plants out at the nursery and you didn't put them on the ground and you didn't do something to insulate them, I mean, some people don't plant them. You could actually probably keep it in like, with enough mulch, you might be able to bury that, build up mulch around that container so deep that it might insulate it enough. But it needs to stay outside.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's an outdoor. It's an offshoot, a mutation from a white spruce, which, you know, is basically a native that wants to live in New York and the Northeast, and it just survives our cold temperatures. It's built for cold.
Mary, thank you very much for the call. While we were doing that call, Delilah, the orange, or is it yellow or orange? I'm terrible with colors.
Yellow, golden.
All right. A very different kind of tomato. What is that one?
So this one is called persimmon. It's actually one of the oldest heirlooms out there. It was identified by Thomas Jefferson.
Ah.
Yeah. So, you know, people often say, what is an heirloom tomato? And technically, an heirloom tomato is any variety that was grown before 1950, which is when hybrid tomatoes came onto the market.
Mm.
So this is a tomato that Thomas Jefferson identified as being something that he really liked and started saving seed, and it has survived over 200 years.
It's an interesting flavor.
It is.
It's lighter. It's almost like a plum in consistency.
It is. It's a really neat flavor. I can see why you would like that one. The Russian, I got to say, is also really neat. That would probably be really good in like a sauce that has a smoky-like flavor.
And other people have picked up on that smokiness.
Yeah, it's a smokiness for sure. And in a salsa, boy, forget about it.
All right. No, it's becoming Food Friday. I like this, and we're a little early. Richard in Pittsfield. Richard, you're on.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Ironically enough, I got some beautiful orange tomatoes that I picked up over in Greenwich, New York. And my raised bed have historically left my tomatoes with a black spot on the bottom that really starts to rot them. I've changed out the soil pretty significantly and wondering if you can lend some insight as to what's going on.
So when you say a black spot, is it where you would normally have what we would call the blossom scar on the very bottom?
Oh, no. It's full-on rot, and it's probably about 60 to 70% of the tomatoes, the large ones, have it.
Okay. And does it start much earlier in the season, or has it just started in the last couple weeks?
Last couple weeks. I mean, my tomatoes have probably just started to produce, as you said, the last 4 to 6 weeks. And, the larger they are, the more obvious it is.
Okay. I mean, it sounds to me like what we call blossom end rot, which is a problem with a calcium deficiency with enough calcium getting to the fruit. And that is exacerbated by hot temperatures because it's hard to keep your plants watered enough. And even if you do keep them watered enough, the rate of transpiration, the amount of water that the plant is trying to move through it, the calcium is just not able to get to the fruit itself.
Mm.
So the blossom end rot is the most likely thing. It's what it sounds like to me, where it covers a large part of the bottom. And certainly mulching your plants well to keep more even moisture distribution in the soil will help with that. It's not usually an actual deficiency of calcium, but I would certainly do a soil test to find out what your calcium levels are like and what your soil test levels are like. Sometimes if you get too much of other nutrients in the soil, it can displace calcium in the transpiration stream. So I would do a soil test and try to even out your watering. And I think next year you could probably have better success.
So the rumor that my sister provided was that there's a black walnut tree nearby may or may not be true.
No, that's actually not true. The black walnut does have a sort of a ileopathic tendencies, so it can secrete, which is true, toxins into the soil. And, you know, so if your plants weren't getting enough water, the black walnut would be probably more of a culprit for taking away water than it would be for poisoning your plants. And so the way this works, without spending too much time on it, is in nursery containers, if you were to take a black walnut tree and plant it with a little seedling, that the chemicals that the root of the black walnut secretes would be enough to kill that little seedling in a lot of trials. There are some plants that are more resistant to that, but it does do that. When you hear about a lot of large black walnut trees and things don't grow under them, the roots are secreting chemicals, but it's not in the quantity that would actually kill shrubs and other plants. It's actually sort of a misconception. What they are really good at doing is taking away water. So a lot of the plants that you see listed as resistant to black walnuts or can live with them generally are really drought tolerant plants, and which means they can tolerate the water guzzling habits of a black walnut. They like water. They're better at a lot of the other plants at getting it. So most of the plants that, you know, theoretically that are planted near black walnut tree would theoretically do pretty good if you could add supplemental water to them. It's not so much that they're poisoning them in high quantities, it's that it's making it really hard for them to live because of water. And tomatoes like even water. So if your garden's close to it and your roots are of the walnut, remember physiologically, the roots of this of any tree are going to stretch out 2 to 3 times the canopy spread. So, and these roots are not the anchoring roots. They're not big, thick, woody roots. These are little fine hair-like roots that are just 12 inches or so under the soil surface. And they can certainly coexist in your garden if it's nearby. So is your walnut partially a culprit?
Richard.
It could be.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for that one. By the way, Fred, before the next call, you brought this thing that looked like an alien pod in. And what is that thing?
Yeah, it's known as a giant puffball. Right.
Wow,
you know, as
that.
Kids, we sort of look for the brown ones because we always wanted to step on them and see all that smoke.
That I've seen.
So that's the same mushroom that you would step on
as a
child.
That's a mushroom.
That's a mushroom.
That looks straight out of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I'm not going to lie.
It certainly does. And it's the same type of mushroom that we would step on that turns brown. So once this thing turns brown, it's no longer palatable. In other words, you can't eat it.
Hang on. I can eat that?
Yeah. So
I eat that?
So
it's the size of a bowling ball.
I'll send you home with a chunk of it and you tell me what you think
next
show.
No one's going to die if I do that.
No. That's, you know, the giant puffball is probably the, I would say, most underrated edible mushroom.
And so, how do you cook it? Well, give me an example.
Yeah, so you could in the simplest way is just slice it and cut it up and saute it in a pan with garlic, a little bit of oil. You could use olive oil. You could use butter. A little bit of garlic is good. A little salt, a little pepper. You don't need a real lot, and it'll have a nice, pleasant flavor. You also could treat it like tofu. So you could chop it up, and it'll absorb flavors from dishes that you put it in. And then my kids and even my own personal favorite, I think the whole family favorite, although probably not the most good for you, but in terms of eating it, is we like to fry it. And I use like a veggie oil or another hot oil, but something that's a little bit hot, like a veggie oil. And we bread it, quick bread, and throw it in a frying pan. And it looks like mozzarella sticks when you're done.
That is amazing.
And we dip it in a marinara sauce. And that's we're probably going to eat that tonight, but not this one. I've
got
a couple
more. Than
more.
Those.
Yeah, I've taken 2 or 3 of them, and there's another 4 or 5. The really important thing to know about any mushroom is that they're sponges for all kinds of stuff, including bad stuff. So these, where you would find them, are not typically in deep, dark, organic old climax forest. You find these on often lawns or meadows.
Yeah.
And as long as it's a lawn that isn't sprayed with chemicals, it's safe. But if they are applying chemicals, mushrooms are just fantastic for absorbing chemicals. And to give you an example of that, like morels, which are my favorite mushroom probably overall, they love to grow under apple trees a lot of times. We find them under old orchards, but you got to be really careful to take them from old orchards
because
they
sprayed
a lot of bad stuff. And we're talking about 50 years ago sprayed, and that stays in the ground for that long.
Yeah.
And those morels, just they're they're, you know, once in a while, you're probably all right. But if you made, you know, sometimes you can find a lot of them, and consuming a lot of bad mushrooms with toxics, that's not good. These came off of a place in my neighborhood called the Glen Grange Conservancy. Thanks for that, guys. And they're not using any kind of pesticides, chemicals. They're not really too worried about the lawn. They're more worried about the historic structure.
And it's definitely a mushroom?
It's 100% puffball. It's one of the easiest ones for beginner foragers to find, because there's not too many things that look like that that you could confuse it with. The only thing that you could confuse that with
is the pods from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Exactly.
And so if I see two Fred Breglias walking around the Landis Arboretum, I'm going to know you're wrong. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email. We'll hit the email bag in a moment. It's not Food Friday. God bless it. It's the gardening show. It's Fred Breglia and Dale Isla Riggs. And, you know, we'll go to the email bag here. This one came in before the show, and this is from Jay. I have over a half acre of land of crabgrass, quackgrass, and foxtail grass interrupted by some patches of lawn. Are those three grasses annuals, so they can only reproduce by seed? I'm trying to pull out plant by plant because they've all gone to seed, and I'm not mowing because I don't want to spread the seed. What is my best course of action this time of year?
All right, no, I can handle that. What's he saying? He wants to keep that foxgrass and the other grasses out of his...
I believe, yes, the crabgrass, quackgrass, and foxtail grass are ruining his lawn. That's the basis.
Yeah, so I know crabgrass is a nightmare, and I believe that's an annual. We don't have the sod father here today, Bob. But in terms of which ones are annuals and which ones are perennials, the thing is they're going to throw out so many seeds, and even the perennial grasses throw out so many seeds, that if you have all these different types of grass around a preserved piece of lawn, you're going to have infiltration. And, you know, so personally, and again, this is coming from a tree guy, so I get away with this, I'm not so concerned about the different types of grasses. I'm actually concerned about it being green through drought periods.
I'm with you.
And, you know, so to me, I'm not as concerned. But if you are, then with all the other types of grass you mentioned coming in around you, and just crabgrass alone is a nightmare to control. It's, you usually got to use a pre-emergent. I believe it's an annual, but it certainly looks like acts like a perennial. And it might even be a perennial. Again, it's not my specialty. But I know that those crabgrasses are just – they're everywhere. To keep them out, you're going to have to put a lot of time in. And if you have all of these other types of grass all around that one area, I would think you're going to have a lot of infiltration. So you're going to have to control it in some capacity.
All right.
And quackgrass is a perennial, and it spreads through rhizomes. So that's going to be particularly challenging to try to do something about.
I say live with it. I mean, it's green. It looks good. I have now come to terms with the bizarre nature of the different grasses in our lawn.
I've taken it a step further, because if you look at trees or shrubs, turf grasses could be thought of as the enemy, because it's better at gathering water and nutrients than your trees and shrubs are. It's a different type of plant. It's called a C4 plant versus like the other ones, which would be like a C3 plant. And that basically just means that it's better at getting water. It's better at growing in harsh sites. It's better at getting all the nutrients, which is why generally it's good to kind of have a wide mulch bed, not high, mulch wide, not high, around your trees, because ultimately you're cutting the competition. Pun intended.
This one's from M. I recently became aware that there are several apps that can help identify plants. I'm concerned about invasive species growing around my property. There are so many of these apps. I'm wondering if any of you could throw out names of ones you consider to be better.
Well, I will say that I've also had some fun playing with apps, because there are an unbelievable amount of them, and everything from mushrooms to woody plants, to even birds now, and insects. So they've got app. They've got, you know, the old saying, they've got an app for that. It's out there, and I have messed with a lot of them. I can't say that I've tried even close to all of them, but I have followed the reviews. When you look at the App Store and you look at which ones are the top reviewed ones, so I've sort of picked them, and I've used them around my own yard just to see how accurate they actually are. And I will say that they're pretty good. Are they 100%? No. Mm-hmm. Do they give me the right answer more than they give me the wrong answer? Yes, they do.
Okay.
So in that sense, they're good. But I do know a person that said, They got poisoned by a mushroom because the app told them it was okay.
Well, that's a lawsuit waiting
to
happen.
So you got
to be careful.
But you got to be really careful. So I always say, you know, watch. The apps are a good backup. It's not a supplement or something that you would replace with good identification.
Okay.
For your yard, wondering if it's an invasive, I think it could be really good. For a mushroom, something that you're going to ingest and consume, I don't think I would trust an app for that.
Delilah?
Yeah, and Department of Ag and Markets, the plant industry division, has quite a listing of the invasive species, invasive plants in New York State. So besides an app, I would just check out some various websites as well.
Yeah.
We don't have enough coverage in Steventown, so I don't tend to use apps.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's some really good websites out there, and Ag and Markets, plant industry would be really good.
Well, here's a question for you, Delilah. This is from Pamela. I've located some wild strawberry plants with relatively large, delicious berries. Is it possible to cultivate them? And if so, how and when would you suggest I do it?
Certainly, you can absolutely cultivate those. What I would do is kind of mark them with some flagging or some type of way to identify them easily next spring. And in the spring, I would dig up some of those quite early, like mid-March, late March, whenever the frost goes out of the ground, and then you can transplant them into the area that you want to be cultivating them.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have a spot as a kid that had extra large wild strawberries, so we kind of did the same thing. Or you, rather than transplanting them, just clear out the area where they're currently growing and remove some of the weed competition and help cultivate them in the area where they're already established.
That makes sense. All right, let's go back to our phone lines here. 800-348-2551. To Poughkeepsie we go. And Margaret, you're on.
Hi, I have a question. I've put a row of forsythias, about 10, 12, 14 bushes in front of my house for visual appeal and childhood memories. A lot of them are blooming and taking off nicely, but single bushes at one end of the planting don't seem to take off. They die. They turn brown. I wonder if there's something I can do, or can I put something else there?
It's only a few of the forsythias on
yes.
either end of your sort of row of them.
Only on one end.
Only on one end. What's different yeah. about that end? What's different?
So the only thing I can figure out is different is that the deers walk through there at night. It's their little path. Is that possible?
Yeah, I wouldn't think it would be deer. So it's dying. They sort of, are they dying from the top down or from the bottom up?
Maybe the bottom up.
So they come from the bottom up. Do you think that, is there any,
Is there anything that might be different about the soil at that end?
So is it possible that the town could have wiring or pipes or something there that I don't know about?
It is possible. My gut feeling is it's probably something with the soil, like maybe drought. I'm thinking it's too dry on one end versus maybe adequate moisture. And if there is something underground there, that would affect the amount of water available. Forsythia is a pretty tough plant. So it doesn't have too many problems. It grows in full sun. It grows in shade. You know, usually the big problem with forsythia is that it doesn't bloom usually in the springtime because of winter damage with the foliar buds over the course of the winter. But generally, if you see one plant and it's only one or two on one end, I would take a closer look at that soil. Did they die just one time or more than once?
More than one time.
So you've replanted it with a brand new plant and then it also died.
Yep.
Do you think there could be any kind of contaminant in that area?
I guess it's possible I could look into that.
Does grass grow in that area? Does grass grow?
Yes.
Does it look the same, the grass, in that area versus? Or does it look different?
No.
It looks different?
It doesn't look as healthy.
Yeah, so then there's something going on, because grass will grow even in places that forsythia won't. So that tells me there's something in the ground. So I would start with it's in New York, you know, probably one of the best places to get a soil test is Cornell University, and you could go to your local cooperative extension and they could tell you how to they'll set you up so you can get your soil sent to the Cornell lab. So they won't do it there, but they'll help you send it. They'll help you get the sample together and tell you what you need and the forms filled out. And it's relatively cheap to get a soil analysis. And they will also come back with a really detailed pH. And hopefully if there's some chemical there, you know, or some kind of something else, they might identify it. So I'd start with that.
And it may be something as simple as an area that didn't get topsoil put on it after construction. It may be that it's just the subsoil so that it's not full of nutrients and doesn't have the topsoil there.
It very well could be.
Which is going to make a big difference.
It sounds like water is probably one of the factors. And if it's all subsoil and it doesn't have topsoil, then the water would not be able to stay in that area very well. Yeah. And then you would see a decreased growth with grass. And so it very much could be that. I don't know if the caller's still on, but one other question I would have is when they dig, do they see any difference in the consistency of the soil of that hole versus the other ones?
That's
and,
a good
you know,
point.
That'd be another test to dig a test hole. Do you see it really gravelly? Then if that's the case and everything else is looking good, then we've solved it. You can skip the soil test. But otherwise, you know, that would be a good way to go.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today with Dale Isla Riggs and Fred Breglia. And we expect Greg and Bob to be back with us in 2 weeks when we reconvene this little panel. Let's go down to Amsterdam. They all went down to Amsterdam. Debbie, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
This year, I planted a wide variety of tomato plants that were blight resistant, resistant to early blight. I mulched underneath them really well so that the soil did not, like, go up onto the plants. I only have raised beds, so it's not like I can do a lot of soil rotation. But other than clearing, I did get some blight. Other than clearing the tomato plant in its entirety and all the mulch off and starting fresh next year, is there anything else I can do to combat early blight?
So you did exactly the right thing with buying blight-resistant varieties. Be aware that there's numerous tomato diseases that will affect tomatoes, and early blight is just one of them. So you may have what's called septoria. You might have some angular leaf spot. You might have some other bacterial leaf spots. So if you really want to solve this, what might be good is to get a sample of those diseased leaves to your cooperative extension service and make sure that it actually is early blight that you have. That's one thing to do. And often with tomato varieties, they'll talk about them being early blight resistant, and they are resistant to a point, but they can be overwhelmed if there's really high levels of inoculum. And so they should more accurately be called early blight tolerant. So there's a difference between resistance and tolerance. But I suspect that you may have some other diseases on those leaves as well. And the general public often will call it blight, but there may be 5 to 8 other leaf diseases affecting those tomato plants. So I would get a sample in and get it accurately identified before you worry about if it's actually early blight. But keep buying those disease-resistant varieties. We grow those in the spring for people to buy. That's what we grow for standard tomato varieties. We grow some disease-resistant ones as well. So always be looking for that.
Thank you for that call. We appreciate it very much. I tried the better. What is it? Better boy, very much like a standard tomato.
It is a standard tomato.
Yep. And then I tried just now the Marnero.
Marnero. Yes.
Really interesting tomato. What is the deal with that?
So Marnero is what we call an improved heirloom. And, you know, there's this thing about heirlooms technically are varieties that are older, were developed
older
before
50.
1950. Yep. But there's a problem with a lot of heirlooms. That's why we have modern varieties. And so the Marnero is what we call an improved heirloom. It's actually a newer variety that has had good traits of tomatoes incorporated with heirloom varieties.
I love it. I think this is a winner.
Okay, so
do you have all these at the berry patch?
Oh yeah,
you're
and
kidding me.
I had to narrow down everything. I had like
that's crazy.
I think I have 20 different varieties.
Wow. All right, let's grab at least one more here, maybe two, before we wrap it up on the gardening show. And Hannah in Windsor, Hannah, you're on.
Hi. I have a question and a comment that's related to one of the earlier callers, if that's all right.
Yeah, I think we have time.
So I think I'll start with the comment, and it's related to black walnut trees. I'm somebody who grew up with an over 100-year-old black walnut tree, and for the person who was talking about the issues that they were having with that, I highly recommend making sure that you're not getting any squirrel storage of the nuts in and around your garden area, because they will release jugalone, which is the toxin that can affect things. And also make sure that you're not putting any of the branches into your mulch or compost, because that can also incorporate it.
Yep, that's a good point, too. The squirrels hiding them in the yard would release higher concentrations of it. So.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
All right, and what's your question, Hannah?
So my question is, what would you recommend as, like, standard plants for a vegetable/herb garden, primarily perennials, preferably, for somebody who has difficulty due to disability for being able to do things like pruning and, you know, excess weeding, things like that.
Yeah.
Kind of set it and forget it plants. What are your recommendations?
Great idea.
One of my favorites is certainly garlic. You know, it can grow well in raised beds. It can grow in the ground. To me, it doesn't require a lot of work. Some people out there might, you know, say, what are you talking about? But I think you can really, if you get good soil and you prep it out, then you could do really well with good spacing and good organic soil. Relatively, I mean, I grew so many big bulbs of garlic this year, and it was during the drought time, and I literally did not water it at all because I just don't have extra water at our house. Otherwise, I would have. And I also use straw to mulch it in pretty good. And then, you know, it doesn't take too much weeding to keep it under control. You know, it's kind of easy, I think. Personally, I think potatoes are also pretty easy, but, you know, in terms of disabled and digging them up, that's not the easiest part of it. So that part's hard. But garlic, you can grab a hold of it and yank it right out. And I actually had my kids do it this year. And, you know.
Oh, child labor. It's
child
cheaper
labor,
that way.
You know,
yeah, it's perfect.
Exactly. And they like it. So, you know, at least for now. They're going to pay me back later,
yeah,
I'm
for sure.
I'm sure I'm sure you've got some more suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, certainly perennial vegetables. There's not a lot of perennial vegetables. Asparagus would be something that you could try, but it might be a little bit tricky with the raised beds. You would want to mulch it well in the fall, but asparagus in a raised bed where you can keep it well mulched and well weeded. Asparagus coming up in May is always such a treat. Strawberries do great in raised beds. You could easily cover them with some netting to keep the birds and some of the insects out, so the strawberries would be easy to do as well. And then there's lots of dwarf varieties of tomatoes, so you don't have to have big, tall tomatoes. You can get some dwarf varieties. Peppers, certainly. Any of the short-statured plants.
Yep, and some of these in containers, in addition to your raised bed, also work well.
All right, Count Basie's playing, so I think we'll have to leave it there, panel. Fred Breglia, how do people find the Landis Arboretum?
It's at 174 Lape Road in Esperance, and it's landisarboretum.org.
And Dale Isla, how do we find the Berry Patch?
TheBerryPatch.net. We do online orders, and you can find us at the Troy Farmers Market every Saturday.
Well, this was so much fun, and the food was so good. While we hung out here, we had all these great tomatoes,
it really was.
And then there's the pod over there, which is scaring me. And thank you both. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Support comes from Honest Weight Food Co-op in Albany. Local, organic, and sustainable groceries for all. Open to the public daily from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Home delivery available online at honestweight.coop. And Basilica Hudson, presenting Jupiter Nights Thursday nights, celebrating creatives through concerts, poetry, conversational gatherings, art exhibits, and more, focusing on local creative community, basilicahudson.org. Jupiter's been beautiful lately, too, so we'll do our astronomy show next week, I think a week from today. Once again, thanks to Fred and Dale Isla for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Susie Chekai screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll eat healthy with Holly Shelowitz. What could go wrong? We'll see you at 2:00.